Dear shooter, don't you just hate being startled? Whether it's that shot timer, someone sneaking up from behind, or maybe that large object your freaking cat just knocked over. You may jump or dodge. Your heart is racing so much you can hear it in your ears. Where did these reactions come from? Today we will chat with Mike DeSargo about what causes these reactions and more. So grab that espresso shooter. It's going to get all science-y up in here.
It's not about protecting the stupid. It's just, it is what it is.
I don't know if you know this, but I'm a self-identifying llama. And it's because I have a quick temper and I like to spit.
You are not safe and you are not sacred and you're both liars.
We're talking about firearms, y'all. Keep it clean.
I can hide one under there.
One what? I don't want to know.
I look like I got ran over by a paint truck on the way to Sherwin-Williams and then backed over by the short bus.
You know, let's talk about the modern trends in transsexual transitions.
Welcome to the Dear Shooter podcast. Dear Shooter is brought to you by WyoTac, empowerment through self-reliance, and by Lucid Optics, on target, under budget.
All right, that comedy of errors there is the signal that it is Thursday. And we've got Mike DeSargo on the phone. This is, Mike's been kind of a mentor of mine and an absolute genius when it comes to what goes on inside the body when you were under stress. Mike, how are you doing?
I'm nervous now. You're kind of overselling me there, brother.
Not even.
Speaking of what's going on in the body, I'm having some funny feelings about that introduction.
Well, funny feelings is what we're all about.
Well, thank you so much for having me on, man. It's a pleasure, an honor, and a privilege, and I very much appreciate the introduction there. I hope to contribute whatever information I could pass along, and if any of it is incorrect, please fact check me, because I'm a learner before anything else. I'm just passing on information.
Well, no, I brought you on as the expert, because I spent some time with you in San Diego, and I watched you do a presentation there about stuff that went way more in depth than we've ever really talked about it. You know, you were telling me things about the adrenal glands and the synapses firing in the brain and what's going on when you're in a fight, and I was fascinated.
Yeah, a funny story about that is I almost canceled on that talk because I was getting over influenza cinco, apparently, because, you know, I get the quad flu shot and I happened to get the flu that wasn't a part of it, apparently. And I was feeling sick as a dog. I think you remember.
Yeah.
When
yeah.
I was like, dude, I might have to bow out. And then I just like mustered up and took my Flintstone vitamins and got well. So, but all that to say, that talk didn't nearly go as the way it was supposed to go. And I even asked them, please don't post this, you know, because I have it in my head. So maybe this could be my redemption and really having some kind of like a organizational thought process that's not torn between the brain fog of being sick.
Yeah, but I mean, come on, you have ADD as bad as I do. So this is going to flow the way it goes.
Yeah.
So what got you started down this path? Like, where did you really start picking up and doing the research into all this?
Oh, that's actually an excellent question. It's the origin story. So I was raised in a disadvantaged community, which is the PC way of saying I was a hood rat, just, you know, ghetto. So I was raised in a violent environment, right? And what I thought, and funny story, the martial arts school I started as a bet that martial arts doesn't work in the street. All that to say that, like, when I tried to whoop my teacher's butt, it didn't work out as planned. And so I became a loyal student. And this place was called Dragon Fighting Arts in South Bay, San Diego. And funny story, it was owned by what I believe, and this is not true because I'm not trying to character shame or like any kind of infamy thing, but word on the street was that he was a drug dealer. And he bought the building and hired different martial arts instructors to train them up to be a black belt in all these different martial arts. So under one roof, we had Muay Thai. I was part of the mantis boxing, which is like a style of Chinese martial arts. They had jiu-jitsu guy. They had like different people. And our school got shot up a few times, and it was just, it was good times, right? And so this is when I was a teenager. And then when I started teaching martial arts in the mid 90s. And I found that, like, the old adage of rehearsal to mastery, 10,000 reps, this whole thing, you know, that was very much the Chinese martial arts way, where you work on these precise motions and motor movements and get really good technique, develop your power, develop your speed, develop all these mechanical attributes, right, in your technique. But when it came down to getting some students to spar and actually pressure test, like, it would always crumble. It would, like, diminish. And I was trying to figure that out because I was still getting into certain episodes of violence, to put it in a PC way. And I was able to do it. My instructor was Chula Vista PD. And before that, he was using it quite a bit. Of course, when he put on the uniform and badge, the level of force, you know, it wasn't as resistive. And when they were, he was still able to apply skill sets. And so why is it that he could apply these skill sets, I could apply these skill sets, but it's extremely difficult to reproduce this level of intricacy in other students. In 2013, I met a guy named Torrin Hill, and he created what's called a simulator. And essentially, it was a way to induce the worst case scenario. When we think about worst case scenarios, we often think about, like, the external environment, like a worst case scenario meaning, oh, you're attacked and he comes at you with a knife, or you're with your family kind of deal, right? These are all things that we project outwards.
Sure.
What Torrin did was say, what's the worst case internal scenario, right? Like, we always train to fight on our best day, but what if you have the flu that day? You know what I mean? What if you're feeling like crap that day? What if you're not ready to, like, we hear about people who can't compete because they have an injury, and so they have to reschedule a fight kind of thing. Well, what if you have that injury? You can't reschedule a fight and it goes down, right? So
right.
There's certain circumstances, some internal psychological things, and he wants to see, how will you really perform under stress? Now, stress is a very generic broad term. I've come to expand that specifically because the neurochemical reaction doesn't discriminate against what kind of stress, whether it's exercise-induced stress, whether it's like a shot timer-induced stress. But it's a very different kind of distraction when we're talking about defensive shooting, when we talk about emotional valence and what induces the magnitude of the emotion that you're experiencing and how to process that psychologically. So that's something that was inspired by the simulator, because he had different ways of inducing panic and worst case scenarios and see how that much that diminishes your performance. And we had some high speed guys. I'm not going to call out the specific teams that were a part of, but there were some high speed guys from, yeah, some, like, if we actually disclosed it, we're like, oh, no way, those guys quit. Right. And, and it's not like a shame thing. This is just a human thing, right? When we get past the brand of whatever agency or department or team that they're on, this comes down to the human level. It's like, what happens with that individual? Because the hardest thing to do is to face your own thought processes and your internal demons kind of things, right?
Right.
And so that's what kind of started me on the path, because I did okay, right? Like it was home to me in that worst case scenario where you're suffering, you're oxygen deprived, you're feeling a sense of a panic or adrenaline and death and dying and suffering. And like, it's hyper realistic. I can't give away the secret sauce. There's NDAs involved because it's very much a psychology based training mechanism.
Sure. Sure.
But if you can paint the picture, like, people pour out pints of blood. I mean, that's an obvious thing that people do, right? To create a realistic environment, like sensory deprivation or sensory enriched environment, where you have loudspeakers playing, say, like an active school shooter type situation, and you have the crying and screaming and things like that, right? But it was all very familiar to me. And so it was like, oh, this feels like home. Yay. You know, and so it's just kind of different. And so in the debrief, when I, you know, talked about it with Torrin, he said something that was counterintuitive, because on the surface, we kind of have this illusion of righteousness and humility by giving credit to your lineage, giving credit to your teachers, giving credit for your skill level. to a system, a martial art, or a certain craft, or certain things that are passed on to you. You know, that's indoctrination.
Right.
Right. I still honor my lineage. I still honor the craft that was passed on to me. But after speaking with Rob, it dawns on me that competence is a responsibility of the end user. The teacher can't make you successful at something. You have to put in the work. And there is kind of a formula, and the missing formula when I was going through my instructor development with Rob Pincus at the time, called the program was combat focus shooting, and really picking apart the startle reaction on the neuroscientific level, how that diminishes performance and why it diminishes your performance, why people don't go into the Weaver stance, like what they're taught to do in the academy or whatever it is. Why is that not reflected in the dash cam footage or the CCTV footage?
Right.
And approaching it in such a way that it works well with the human body, so it's far more intuitive. And that got me thinking. It's like, oh, there's these other facets of the human weapon system, which is a phrase that was developed by Dr. Robert Smith of the Direct Action Medical Network. I spent some time with him. He happens to do the same martial arts that I do, so he and I hit it off quite well. And he has the same high-speed brain, so, you know, like, I really need to reconnect with the guy. But talking to him, learning from Rob, getting humbled by Rob intellectually, you know, I'm trying to push back and trying to really ask, like, what's the duration? Because, like, there's that level of skepticism. It's like, will this happen? And his answer was non-zero. And, like, it took me a time to process that. I was like, can we curse on your show? I'm not going to curse.
Yes, absolutely. But, please do.
I was going to say, if he says PC one more time.
So
PC, personal computer.
Let me back you up for just a minute. Because yeah, sure, this is something I've been teaching a lot of IDS classes lately. And one of the things that I inevitably get in almost every class, and you've probably seen this teaching the IDS CFS program too, is you always get that one guy that sits there and says, I don't flinch.
Right.
And my question it every time is to ask him, okay, why is that a positive?
Right. So
because that startle flinch, that is our, you know, primordial brain protecting command and control.
Right. So there's two, in my, if I'm oversimplifying it, two possible scenarios. Either he's in denial.
Yes.
That he startle reacts. Actually, there's three possible scenarios. Or there's something clinically wrong with him, right?
Right.
Where you have, because what's happening with fight or flight, you actually have more responses. Mm-hmm. You have fight, flight, posture, submit, or fawn, you know, where you just kind of freeze.
Right.
And you just dissociate, because that's a real psychological phenomena, where you kind of dissociate from your identity and you just watch yourself being murdered, kind of thing, as a way to protect yourself from the suffering as you die. Like that's kind of a mechanism there. So that's one way that someone might not have a startle reaction.
Right.
Like there's certain clinical things that may be responsible for, but if depending on the background of the individual, right, what may happen is that there's some people that have had some level of post-traumatic adaptation, meaning that they experience danger to such a degree, maybe at an early age, that they become hypervigilant in a positive way. So they almost always have a high level of anticipation and almost always have recognition of early indicators before things start to actuate, right? And so if you have a high level of anticipation, the chances of you being surprised or startled diminishes. Now, that's not to say that he doesn't flinch. Let me make that clear. What I'm saying is that he probably has a low frequency of being startled, potentially because of the adaptation to a threat on that person's life, that they're always hypervigilant, whether it's a disorder, meaning that like their physiology goes into this rapid neurochemical dump of adrenaline and things of that nature and can't discern the stimuli from the perceived threat from the actual threat, is when things become a disorder. But an adaptation is being able to recognize potential changes in baseline that could be a threat, and your brain rapidly orients and processes and still goes through the body's natural reactions to process that information and disqualify that stimuli as a threat, right? Or if it is a threat, you've processed it so far ahead of time, that you're now in a level of anticipation where you're actuating your skills before you get to the startle reaction.
Right.
So that's a possibility. The probability of that.
I think most of it's ego.
Yes, exactly. That's what I was alluding to. The probability of that being true is probably unlikely. What we're most likely to encounter is that startle reactions is associated with cowardice, and people just don't want to say that they get startled or they react. So they undervalue the protective mechanism of the startle reaction. It's the most likely case.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that comes down to, and it is ego. Like, people don't, because they associate that startle reaction with fear.
Right.
And they don't want to admit that things can be scary. But, you know, once you get them past that of, you know, look, when somebody threatens your life, it's scary.
Right.
And it's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is, we're all heroes in our own story, right? We're the center character in the movie called Your Own Life. And we never see ourselves as the villain. And in some cases, we might see ourselves as a victim, but we'd like to see ourselves as a hero, especially when we're training to win. We want to envision the win. And a lot of times that disillusions us to thinking that we should win in a certain way without the element of fear, without the element of being attacked. But the very nature of defensive shooting is that you are the victim. So that's the first step.
Right.
You are the victim of a violent crime. And the fear is what's triggering this skilled response. And if you're triggering a skilled response, then we should peel it back and work well with the fear mechanism. I have a close friend of mine, Mikhail Vega is his new name. He was a former team guy. He has a Sean Ryan Show podcast. It explains quite a bit about his transformation. They go into a bit about his reputation on the SEALs. And he was kind of a Darth Vader dude, right? And he was talking about his time overseas where he didn't feel fear when he was out there. But later in his meditation, it all started coming back. And what happens is when you're in that kind of lifestyle, learning things like emotional functioning is a growth process. It takes some time. And that what emotional functioning is really understanding the utility of the emotions, what each emotion is signaling. It's signaling a change in the environment to motivate you to take action, to change the environment or prepare for something. Right. But when you're in this kind of armed profession, you don't have time to learn how to do all that. You need to learn how to do your job and then make life and death decisions quickly. And then when it comes to emotions, you just got to box it up and stow it away. You don't have time to feel. You need to think.
Right.
And so the quickest solution is just don't feel, just think and do your job. But that doesn't mean that the fear is not there. So what happens when you get people who say things like, I never get scared, I don't get startled reaction, what's happening is that person hasn't allowed themselves to experience what's actually there. And the proof of concept is road rage, right? What's the cause of road rage? It is when someone cuts you off, there's a moment that person put your life on the line. And in that fraction of a second, it's triggered by fear. But what happens is that we replace fear unhealthily with anger. And the anger prompts you to change the circumstance as a solution to fix whatever scared you. And that's what road rage ultimately is that you're trying to eliminate the thing that put your life at risk.
That's interesting. I've never heard it explained that way, but that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I got to give credit to Jake Weskerchin of Zephyr Wellness and Walk the Talk America. His videos on emotional functionings are fantastic. That's what inspired a lot of my trajectory towards really understanding how to leverage emotions, because we only learn how to use half our humanity, which is intellect. We're taught that emotions are bad. What it is our intuition. It signals a change faster than we can become aware of what's happening. Right. So it's a reactive thing. It happens before we know something's happening. Emotions, you're feeling emotion before you know why you're feeling that emotion. But once you understand what emotion you're feeling, what the utility of that emotion is, then you're better off balancing your intellect with this. I'm feeling this emotion. So that's telling me that I need to do something about this.
Right.
Obviously, the algorithm isn't going to always be that like lengthy. But you start to recognize that I'm feeling anger or I'm feeling contempt. Contempt is the utility is about tribalism, where something foreign is threatening the tribe's way of life. That's what contempt is. So you need to protect whatever and sustain whatever that is. So anyways, I apologize for interrupting you, but
I just had to
give credit to Dr. Jake Wiskuchen and his work with emotional functioning.
No, you're fine. And one of the things you touched on, you know, you talked about the fight, flight, freeze responses. Mm-hmm. And, I something that took me a long time to wrap my head around, and this is pure ego, right? I just had to take my ego out of it, that sometimes flight, sometimes running away is the right option.
Yeah, 1,000%, right? So we shouldn't teach by telling stories, but I gotta tell the story. So there's a club that used to exist in San Diego called East Street Alley, and it's like that was like one of the spots to go to, open till 4 a.m. And at the bar, there's this like maybe 5'1" Vietnamese dude, just signing his thing or whatever, and he accidentally bumped like this Devo looking dude, this like big buff guy, the tough guy looking dude, and he accidentally bumped him. The dude spilled his drink onto his shirt, so he turns to this like 5-foot Vietnamese dude, starts ripping into him. And what I remember is like the way this guy projected his voice, he just barked at the dude, and like everybody stopped and looked like, what the hell's going on? And he's swelling on this guy, just set tripping on this guy, just leaning into them, ripping into him. And the little dude's just taking it. And when the guy like puts his head forward, like he's gonna hit the dude, you know how people like do that to make people flinch?
Sure.
The dude just takes his pen and just stabs him in the neck. And it must have hit his trachea or something, because all I remember is the sound in his voice from this to this like squealing, like dying dog kind of thing, like panic. The sound of him unable to breathe and just panicking. And it was a wild experience, man. And that's ego, and it's one of those things where protecting the ego can lead to a lot of poor decisions, and especially when it comes to training, right? When it comes to training, if we pursue things that make us look and feel good for that confirmation bias, we want to feel here, then that's, I think, subconsciously, not to antagonize certain people's choices, but, when they shave time off the shot timer, it's a false sense of readiness, in my opinion, because it doesn't really prepare you in context. Those metrics don't translate to a defensive shooting.
Right.
But it feeds the ego for sure. When we want to train with SEALs or MARSOC guys for, say, CCW purposes, like we get this false sense of security because there's an appeal to authority there where this guy killed people overseas. He should be able to teach me how to do this, but the context is entirely different, right?
Right.
While there is maybe some things that are transferable, it's not quite context specific. So, there's a lot of luck that has to take place for you to be able to access the skills that are commonly being taught. Not to discount some of the programs that they teach, but it's predicated on a lot of other variables from the armed profession that they were in. And so to your point with ego impacting training, impacting decision-making, impacting whether or not you should run, these are all important facets that will protect you both physically, legally, and otherwise.
Right. And well, and to your point, like those classes, I'm not going to say they're wrong, right? Because having that sub 1 second draw to one shot, or in having those skills, that's great, but you have to pressure test them in context, number one, and understand that you're not going to respond in less than a second. You have to react and understand the threat first.
Right.
So those time frames go right out the window.
Well, and I don't know about you, but my threat would probably not be 2D and standing still.
Right.
Yeah, 1,000%. And that's the thing, right? It's not that the training is wrong. My issue is the inferences are wrong, right? Like when I was started trying to think about hitting people, and the old method of testing how hard you could hit with breaking bricks, that used to be a metric of the inference was, oh, if I could break like 12 bricks, that means I should be able to knock someone out. But No, it's not about how hard you could hit. It's about timing, depth perception, trajectory, angles, ability to read body language, or ability to read the depth perception with, you know, there's so much more cognitive skills involved with knocking someone out, because you could tap someone on the jaw if you time it right and they'll go lights out, right? You don't need that much force.
Right.
So it's the same thing with chasing these mechanics, these microseconds to work on your speed or heavier, like going to the biggest caliber to affect trauma. Like, those aren't the right metrics when it comes to violence interacting with humans, right? Or even hunting animals. You know, there's certain things when you start really looking at organic matter, there's other things in organic interaction. There's other variables that are greater than these sterile metrics. And I just have to put this out on the soapbox, right?
Right.
When you take the scientific method, because the argument for a lot of those metrics is that it's an objective scientific metric, right? You remove a lot of these variables and you isolate how fast you could do a thing. But the thing is, that's how fast you could do a thing when you take away all those variables. So what that should tell people is, when you reintroduce that variable, then it's no longer transferable. So that metric is now meaningless unless you plan to do that in the same sterile environment. Right? That's the scientific method. That's like what you should probably understand, that it, the level of confidence that you're developing is a level of false confidence when you add the context back in play. And some people try to like compensate for that by saying, oh, we'll do this and then we'll do the scenario. Then when you really look at the time splits, it's not meaningful. So you're investing all this ammo, all this effort and energy, shaving micro tenths of a second off something,
right,
that could have been otherwise used towards knife control concepts with Aaron Jannetty. I just got to give him a shout out because it's one of the best like edged weapon defenses programs out there. Aaron is a brilliant guy, but like there's other things you can work on to remediate violence besides that, to invest in your time, energy, money, you know, that you can work on.
Right. Well, and you know, you talk about eliminating variables, you know, if from a shooter perspective, we do that all the time, especially when we're doing like long range stuff, right? Because yeah. What we're trying to do is, okay, we've got you on a chronograph and your speeds are off, you know, 50, 70, 80 feet per second. Well, okay, so let's break that down. Let's try and eliminate all the variables and figure out what's causing that. You know, we're going to start with the powder charge. We're going to start with the seating depth. We're going to start with the neck tension. All of those things, we're going to try and eliminate that to figure out what's going on. But when you go to take that shot on your trophy elk, or, you know, you're that sniper in Afghanistan, all those variables are going to be present.
Right. And to that point, I absolutely eliminate variables as a diagnostic tool. Right. So I should do this soon, but the way I leverage dry fire to diagnose anticipation of recoil is as a way to bring the jerking of the trigger into people's conscious awareness. Because what happens when people dry fire, they start to anticipate no recoil. Right. So as long as there's no recoil, then they're anticipating it to just go click. So they're actually conditioning themselves to be really good when there's no click. But then the second recoil happens, there's an explosion in front of your face, the gun starts to jump, then the same instinctive reactions to try to catch the gun before it goes bang, and all the other psychological things that induces anticipation of recoil starts to come back into play. So what I like to do is take the magazine out, so there's a live round. The gun cycles after they shoot that round. And then the following round, when they, if they don't know that there's not a magazine in it anymore, then they see the magnitude of how much they move the gun when they press that trigger. Right? Eliminate the variable, bring that into the conscious awareness. They're like, holy crap, I really threw the gun to the side when I was pressing the trigger. I didn't realize I was doing that. And do that a few reps by mixing it with recoil and not letting them anticipate when there will be a recoil and when there will not be a recoil. But doing enough dry fire so they condition themselves that it's okay to press the trigger without trying to catch the gun, without trying to overreact to the explosion happening in front of their face. Having maybe do 3 to 5 dry fire reps, reintroduce recoil, randomly take the magazine out without them knowing. Or there's certain ways to do it, and I'll put it on video. But that's one of those ways that we use it as a diagnostic tool, right? So there's value in eliminating variables as a diagnostic tool. So the student can learn.
Right.
But as a way of developing a false sense of confidence to say that, like, this is going to directly translate to the fight, I think is a dangerous thing to present to a student.
Right. Well, because you can't introduce panic and fear in a training environment. There's really no way to do it. At least not effectively. Well,
you bring me all the time. I thought that was the goal.
Yeah, she does inspire fear.
Yeah, so that's a very specific training method. And there's all kinds of stuff. So the risk is actually traumatizing the student. Like, there is a way. Like, there is a formula. Like, there's a way to do it. And the frequency, so there's a delicate balance. Like, there's a certain level of anticipation because you're giving consent essentially to experience traumatic violence, you know. And there's a way to do it in a safe way to induce panic, fear, anxiety, all that stuff. But there's a high risk that if it's not done well, that you can actually traumatize the student.
Right.
And then get the inverse effect where now they're myelinating the negative, poor responses that resulted from the panic fear, where that's becoming the habit rather than the positive outcome that you're looking for. So there's a way to do it. It's just the utility of it. I think there's steps we can take before going to a panic fear simulation.
Right.
There's emotional functioning, there's a startle reaction, there's ways of working well with the human body, doing all these other things first to develop good habits. On the range, on the mat, whatever the case may be, before actually going to a panic fear simulation. I think that there's a healthy way to do that.
Right. So now let me ask you this, and this is something I've been diving into a lot lately, is kind of the evolving threats that we face. And one of the things I went through in one of the IDS classes, the last couple that I've done, we always talk about the plausibility principle, right? And it's that, you know, we're going to focus on that 1 to 2 attackers at 9 to 15 feet, but that's not really reality anymore. You know, we're looking at flash mobs. We're looking at active home invasions. We're looking at, you know, active shooters. That 1 to 2 attackers, that mugger, that's becoming a lower percentage now.
Yeah, and it's cultural too. Right. Like, I was talking to our boys down south of the border, and throughout South America, you get this kind of robbery where they approach you close quarters with the gun drawn. And so, like, the idea of racing to your gun while moving laterally is that riskier than a stealth presentation?
Right.
It's a hard problem to work through. And that then becomes a subjective problem down to the end user, right? Are they more athletic than they are stealthy?
Right.
Like, if you don't know how to do sleight of hand, you probably shouldn't do that, right? So there's like, do you do sleight of hand or do you do this? And in a group setting, what do you teach a group, right? And what sense of confidence do you want to instill in them? The reason why it's wiser, and I mean, depends, right? If you're inside one arm's reach, of course, you go to try to control the gun and do all that. But if you're outside two arm's reach, do you still move laterally? Well, the fundamental answer is, when we look at probabilistically, moving laterally and getting your gun out and putting down rounds down range is probably the best chance you have, unless like you're practicing like some kind of sleight of hand presentation because you're a magician or whatever, you know what I mean? Like, you just you practice it to the degree where you know how to sleight of hand your gun out, and doing that under duress, doing that while someone has a hand on you pushing and pulling. I mean, again, and that's the buoyancy when you actually run it. If someone puts their hands on you, now you're inside one arm's reach and you're going to control the gun,
right?
And so the context, I think, when we talk about outside two arms reach, that is still the most universally applicable, and things like active shooter scenarios are then in a scenario where you're likely not the direct target and you're likely at a distance,
right?
And that then calls for a unique training style where you are potentially shooting at greater distances than inside 7 yards or so. It creates a different paradigm and calls for a context-specific class, an active killer class or active shooter class, where there's certain considerations with like background chaos. And this kind of adds to your point. It's still on point, I think, trying not to go too off topic. But the run, hide, fight idea, right? And mm-hmm. when people think about run, hiding, and fighting, evade, barricade, all that good stuff, right, that we teach, when we talk about evade, evolving the evasion to not just to be running straight down a funnel of fire in an active shooter situation, right? Where the priority is, when we talk about barricading, evade and barricade, would be to, depending on what's the circumstance, try to get low and get behind some kind of cover or concealment to get out of the lane of fire. Because what you were saying with the data is changing, especially when it comes to active shooters, where now, for example, on my day job with Pinkerton, we're standing up some security programs for private schools. And in certain states like Utah, they just passed a bill where they're requiring the Guardian program, where a teacher, they need to have at least one armed teacher and one armed school resource officer or one armed security agent. So that's at least two more guns on the campus. Right. And so now when it's an active shooter situation, it's not just the rounds coming from the active shooter, but it may be coming from other directions, either 90 degrees to you or directly in front of you, or who knows what direction is coming in based on the responders, right? And so now you got to look at that risk rather than just evading as far as you can, as fast as you can. You want to prioritize evading to a barricade of some kind that puts some kind of objects between you and different directions of the rounds that are being sent, and being low enough to try to avoid being in the trajectory. Because when people think of responding to an active killer, they're still thinking high center chest.
Right.
And that still needs to evolve specifically to taking a knee and reducing the risk of hitting bystanders by having this upward trajectory shot.
Right.
So that reduces the risk of hitting background, people in the background and such. And so that it's a very context specific thing, right? Whether it's this kind of, do I do the sleight of hand presentation of the gun, or, you know, is it an active killer? Like all these different contexts, I think, call for specific end user courses based on the specific need. Then the question then becomes, is there a large enough people concerned with that? But I still think that the IDS and DSF programs resolved a high percentage. Even though the data is changing, I think it still addresses most of the skill sets more uniformly than if you were to do something more specific, like training for an active killer and the things that you would need to do in that scenario versus going to South America where the gun's already out, then they might need to do sleight of hand or whatever, because they're maybe in that weird space where they're not inside one arm's distance. They're just inside two arms distance and you're too far to control the other person's gun.
Right.
You know, then maybe, you know, because that seems to be the case with a lot of the robberies in South America. It's the most important thing.
Yeah. And I'm totally with you. Like, I think that it, especially like the IDS program, a lot of this stuff still applies. It's just a matter of, you have to think about these different contexts than what we kind of originally put forward to them.
Right. And that just reminded me, happy Mother's Day, Brandy. I apologize for not saying that earlier.
Thank you.
I drug her out on the range and made her set steel all day.
Yeah. And it got me thinking with Mother's Day, and this connects to the context of things, is that oftentimes, this is just my presumption, so correct me if I'm wrong, and this presumption is based on the females that I've taught on the range, that a lot of these programs revolve around men, and then women have to say, I can't do that because of this, right? Whether it's an anatomical thing or if it's a, like, I hear a lot, women's fashion generally doesn't have pockets integrated with them.
Oh, God, so, yeah.
Mm. Well, know, so, pockets, sort of, if you're hiding a Tic Tac.
I feel attacked.
No, no, that's okay. The biggest complaint I've ever. I mean, she was upset because our granddaughter bought a dress that had pockets, like functional pockets.
She could put a juice box in those things. I can't even put a pocket knife in mine. What the heck?
Right. So that's where, for Mother's Day, I wanted to bring up a topic that revolves around women that men should adapt to. You know, flip the script a little bit. Right. I did a talk for Not Me SD. There was the Sexual Assault Awareness Month this past month, and hopefully contributed. I try not to mansplain anything. You know, I generally feel like it's out of my lane to really understand what women go through. But understanding the data where sexual violence is vastly perpetrated by someone you know and trust, not a stranger in the park, not the like random horny jogger you know, that's going to tackle you and do all that. That's not likely the case. And my recommendation was, when you really look at the dynamics, what the perpetrator of sexual violence, what they're leveraging as a weapon is trust. It's someone that you know and that you thought you trust, or they're in a position of authority. So whether it's something in the workplace or something like that, right? Where your boss says something or does something inappropriate and you don't know what the appropriate way to respond is because it's a person of authority kind of thing, right? And so, or even if it's an ex or something, there's something that I call, you know what mission creep is, right?
Yes.
It's when, your responsibilities, just add this to it. And then
exactly.
You add that to it,
yep.
And it just creeps up. So there's kind of a consent creep when there's a trust involved, where that boundary keeps getting pushed just a little bit further. And oftentimes with exes, it becomes problematic because they're so familiar with each other that even escalating to physical violence becomes mutually consensual sometimes, right? Because they're just so comfortable expressing themselves to the degree of violence, right? And so I talked to a victim of domestic violence, and she was absolutely putting some blame on herself. You know, it's like, well, I shouldn't have said that. I'm like, are you kidding me? that doesn't justify it, right? But that's kind of the mindset, right? And so the recommendation when it comes, because the question is, well, if that is the cause of rape and sexual violence, then that kind of antiquates a lot of these like self-defense hands-on classes to some degree. And there's value for that, for self-defense in general, but when we're talking about sexual violence and things of that nature, the what's being violated is trust. That's the weapon that's being used against you,
right?
And so to use parenting for Mother's Day as an analogy, when it's time to tell kids to go to bed, right, when you're setting that boundary that at 8:30 p.m. screen is off, right, or 8 p.m 7:30, whatever time that you establish, the TV is going to turn off, right? And if you tell them, hey, it's 8, turn off the TV, you're going to get a lot of pushback. You're going to get a lot of tantrums. The technique is to give people an off-ramp, so that way it's not one will versus another person's will. It's an off-ramp where, say, you're on the highway, the direction that's going is no longer an option. They need an off-ramp to go a different direction because it is not going to go past 8 p.m. with the TV on. Just full stop. Like, once that boundary is there, we're not crossing that boundary. There's an off ramp. Like, when you talk about what's happening in Ukraine, like Vladimir Putin, they need to give him an off ramp to bail out of the war. If they don't give him an off ramp, then he has no choice but to win that war. Right.
Right.
So it's kind of the same with kids, where if you don't give them a choice, then you're going to get a lot of protests. So with kids, when it's 8 p.m. rolls around and time to turn off the TV, it's not a question of turn it off or telling them turn it off and contesting that. It's a matter of, all right, it's 8 p.m. Do you want me to turn it off, or do you want to turn it off and brush your own teeth? You know, giving them that choice, it's either I'm going to turn it off or you're going to turn it off kind of thing. But there's no other option. Those are the only options, right?
Right.
So when it comes to things like inappropriateness in the workplace, setting a boundary of once there's a thing that's not cool, and just saying, hey, listen, we can't go that direction. You know, I could go to HR or you could stop. You know, it's an ultimatum, but we're just not going down that direction. It's not happening. You know, it's not an appropriate thing to do. And the fear is always like, I don't want to be mean. I know Brandy doesn't have a problem being mean. She'll just punch a motherfucker in the face.
Face, Adam's apple, junk, whatever.
Whatever, target of opportunity. She'll be grateful for the opportunity.
She doesn't go center mass anymore. I've ingrained it in her too far that people wear body armor now.
So punch to the pelvic region is what you're saying?
Yeah, if I'm being nice that day.
Yeah, so I mean it's something that is recommended over some kind of like, if someone tackles you while you're jogging, this is how you protect yourself from rape. But really developing the habit, the idea of knowing what your boundaries are, what your barriers to developing boundaries are, because there's certain fears that stop people from establishing boundaries, whether they don't want to be mean or, they're, for example, if you're out with a group of girls and there's this dude that wants to dance with you and the girls, yeah, dance with them. Don't be a bitch. And now there's this peer pressure thing, right? Like there may be some deeper layers. This kind of goes back to emotional functioning and the value of taking care of your mental health and working through whatever demons that cause you to be a people pleaser and value other people's happiness over your own suffering, right?
Right.
You're like, oh, okay, I guess I'll do it for the team. This sucks for me, but as long as everybody else is happy, right? There's a deeper thing that's happening there, right? And so these are certain tools and where I'm getting at with this is that men don't want to talk about this because we think that we'll just suck it up and do it. But the reality is, like, I could call out any dude and show precisely where the same mechanism of action is happening. It just looks different to men, but it's the exact same thing, right? And
damn, you're going to make me go look in the mirror now.
Yeah, this is kind of a side note, but like psychedelic assisted therapy, it's probably one of the hardest things that guys can do. Like you could go through buds. You could put yourself through all kinds of physical torture. You could lift the heaviest weights. You could do the longest endurance races and torture your physical body. But when it comes to looking into your own mind and letting the emotions exist that are actually there and processing those emotions, that's one of the hardest things to do.
Yeah, no, I won't. I refuse. Well, listen, we're kind of coming down to it.
You're right.
Tell us where we can find you. I know you were at Stronghold Defense.
Yeah, Stronghold Dynamic is company now. I was gonna run a joke, but yeah, Stronghold Dynamic is both the website strongholddynamic.com, also social media, Instagram, Facebook. You can find me at @Mike_Dasargo, DASARGO. Or you can call or text at 609-917-9017.
Oh, that was a mistake.
Jokes on you, I get paid per text. I'm kidding. No, you don't get charged. It's not a 900 number.
Oh.
I just need friends.
Well, awesome, brother. So, I appreciate you coming on. And it, like, my brain now hurts.
And I apologize. I went off all kinds of tangents. I know we didn't get into the nitty gritty of the neuroscience stuff. There's more we need to get into. So.
Well, we do. And we need to do this when Wilson is here, because he'll pick your brain like crazy. But this was awesome. I think this is a real good taste of we can get into this some more.
Yeah, absolutely. And I hope you guys can walk away with questions and reel me in when I go off on these tangents.
No, I'm still, like I said, I'm fascinated. So
cool.
But hopefully we got some good information out. And if you can't figure out what's going on in your brain, you can just blame your gun.